Nice talking about tonight. I will be speaking about a project with Chris and a couple of others, with Human Kabliassel and Sean Tulin, who's a really great postdoc with us out of Michigan. And what we looked into is trying to connect the baryon density to the dark matter density. And we came up with a specific scheme that we call hylogenesis, right? I should probably say helogenesis, I think that's the correct pronunciation. Helo is apparently Greek for matter. And one of the interesting things of our scheme is it has very, very unusual dark matter direct detection signals. So I'll try to get to that as well. Okay, so I think we're all very familiar with what I would call the standard picture for the origin of dark matter, the origin of baryons. Your dark matter comes from thermal freeze-out. Your baryons, instead, come from an asymmetry. So at some point, you create a baryon asymmetry. The symmetric part annihilates away, and what you're left with is the remnant asymmetry. So for example, leptogenesis or electric baryogenesis or what have you. So from this point of view, your creation of dark matter is completely independent, which is the mechanism for where it comes from the production of dark matter. On the other hand, simply numerically, the observed dark matter density is roughly 5 times the observed baryon density. And this starts to look like a little bit of a funny accident. I mean, it could just be an accident, but the fact that these two numbers are so close, that it does give you pause, and at least makes me wonder if perhaps it could come from a related origin. So this was our first piece of motivation. The second piece of motivation, at least for me, is a little bit more technical, and that is moduli oscillations. We heard about this earlier from Adrian. And, well, let me start off by saying that this is my own personal bias, but I feel that low-energy supersymmetry is a fairly well-motivated way to extend the standard model. And a very common feature of supersymmetric theories are light scalar moduli fields. So these are fields with very flat potentials. They can come from, let's say, supersymmetric flat directions or in various string compactifications. They seem to arise very generically. And in many cases, the masses of these light scalar states are set by the scale of supersymmetry breaking. And typically, the mass you get for this modulus field is on the order of the gravitational mass, so M3 house. Now, if I want to have low-energy supersymmetry from the phenomenological point of view, to be coming in the superpartners around the TUD, this actually limits, in most mediation mechanisms, the value of the gravitational mass. And roughly, my gravitational mass should be less than about 1,000 TUD.
Is that time of QBN? Is that the bound is very high, right?
Let me get to that. My next slide. So the thing is, the fact that these moduli have flat potentials coincides with them coupling very weakly to other matter. And in particular, they typically are long-lived. And parametrically, there's some UV scale characterizing their coupling to visible matter. And their decay rate goes like the cube of their mass over the square of this UV scale, characterizing their coupling to visible matter. So what happens in the early universe is typically you start with your modulus field to approach from the origin. It's stuck from Hubble damping early on. Eventually, when the Hubble damping turns off, the field oscillates. The oscillation energy can dominate the energy density of the universe. And finally, the modulus field decays and reheats everything around it in the integrators. Now, the thing is, and this is what you're getting to, is that for modulus masses below about 1,000 TeV, the reheating temperature, or the reheating scale, occurs fairly late. And, for example, parametrically, you get a reheating temperature of about 200 MeV for modulus masses of about 1,000 TeV. So this is still safe in terms of BBN, where you want to reheat to above about 5 MeV. And this is also not a problem for dark matter. It's not too hard to produce dark matter non-thermally through the decay of the modulus. That's one of the decay problems. The challenge, though, is if you try to do baryogenesis, there just aren't that many baryogenesis mechanisms that can operate at such a low temperature. So, for example, the standard ones, such as GUT or electric baryogenesis or leptogenesis, all require reheating up to at least the TeV scale. So this is the second piece of motivation for me, at least, trying to find a low energy or a mechanism for baryogenesis that works for lower reheating temperatures.
Sorry, but I have to ask again. Now, this reheating temperature, I mean, Now, it's not taking into account the decay of the gravitinus, it's the decay of the model that you play. So you could still have the gravitinus stick around for longer and decay later.
Yes, that could still be a problem. But again, I'm taking this as motivation. I've been actually, in some sense, I'm taking supersymmetry as a motivation. I'm not going to give you a supersymmetric model. So I'm taking this as motivation for our construction, but we're not going to supersymmetrize our construction at this point. Okay, so we set out to look for a unified way to generate baryons and dark matter. And one mechanism that achieves this is asymmetric dark matter. And the idea here is that the dark matter and baryons share a conserved charge. And the conserved charge of baryons fixes the density of the dark matter. In the sense that the density of the dark matter is now no longer just a thermal relic, instead it's set by the asymmetry that's related to the baryon asymmetry. So this is not a new idea. It's been revived in the past few years by Kaufman Zurich and company. And we wanted to take this idea and go one step further. We actually want to realize our hidden anti-baryons. We actually want to realize our dark matter is hidden anti-baryons. So this is also not a new idea. So later Woodrow put something along these lines a while back, and then it's also been investigated in other contexts by Ledwood. What we came up with is a very concrete low-temperature mechanism for this to occur. And again, we call it heliogenesis, Greek for matter creation. So at this point, Chris Palmer's an apology, and I'll give you the apology. We came up with our dark matter, asymmetric dark matter construction at about the same time that other people did. And somehow, I don't know where it came from, a lot of these constructions have wacky names. So we have heliogenesis, which Chris came up with. He was especially literary. We also have darkogenesis, chromogenesis, exogenesis. I actually have this name independently, but we've ended up changing it to heliogenesis when we found it. Baryomorphosis, angiogenesis, cladogenesis, and a few others that I haven't. And plus, there are various other papers with a, let's say, more tasteful title. I'm sorry. Okay, so anyway, back to heliogenesis. We have a very simple model for it. At this point, it's not supersymmetric. And it consists simply of the standard model, plus a few new direct fermions and a new complex scale. So we take the standard model, we add two X particles, and we assign these X particles baryon number plus one. So this is a generalized baryon number in the sense that these X particles don't carry any QCD charge. We also introduce a light Y fermion and a light Phi scalar, and we write down the following interactions. We couple X, our two flavors of X, to UDD. So this is the lowest dimensional gauge invariant operator in the standard model that carries non-zero baryon charge. And we also couple our X to Y and Phi through UCalcol. So this, okay, we want to trademark this coupling as a neutron portal. I haven't seen this name before, but the coupling has been used in various other contexts, also for baryogenesis, also in the past. Okay, so we have really simple couplings, and we add one more ingredient, and I'll tell you why we need this other ingredient in a second, but we add a new U1 prime hidden gauge symmetry. The standard model is uncharged under this. Our X fields are uncharged, but Y and Phi carry equal and opposite charges. Now, we couple this hidden U1 to the standard model to gauge genetic mixing with hypercharge in the same way that, much like what Jim did in the models he told you. And the upshot of this is that after you take into account the genetic mixing, you generate a coupling of standard model fermions to the Z prime of this U1 prime gauge. Okay, so the way these couplings generate matter goes like this. We assume that we have some sort of late reheating process, let's say moduli decay or late reheating after inflation, and that this reheating produces equal numbers of X and anti-X non-thermally. And what I mean by non-thermally is that you reheat to a temperature much below the X mass, but you have a much larger than thermal density of the X particles. So you have a non-thermal X density. These X particles decay with CP violation, and given the couplings I wrote down, there are two decay modes. can go into three quarks or go into Wi-Fi. And the Wi-Fi part, we assume, eventually annihilates into these Z primes. And the leftover Wi-Fi, at the end of the day, is going to be our hidden dark matter. Okay, so in pictures, our first step, we produce X and anti-X. At this point, we haven't produced any net variant number. We haven't violated our generalized variant number. We just produce some X and some anti-X. No problem. In step two, we have decays. Given the couplings, X can go to UDD or anti-Y, anti-Phi. And X bar can go to three anti-quarks or Y5. This happens essentially instantaneously. And given the couplings I wrote down, you can insert a non-trivial CP-violating phase. And the upshot of that phase is that you can have different partial widths for X goes to three quarks versus anti-X goes to three anti-quarks. Now, for CPT, the difference between these channels has to be matched by the difference in these channels. So the upshot is that this decay has a little bit of an excess. This decay has a little bit of a deficit. But I make up for that excess and deficit by my anti-X decaying a little bit more into Y5. And vice versa for X into anti-Y, anti-Y. So in pictures, we have CP violation through group interference, much like you would have in, let's say, direct leptogenesis. We have an asymmetry. Defined as a decay symmetry between X goes to three quarks and X goes to three anti-quarks. And this depends on some CP violating phase and some set of parameters, some set of mass parameters. Now, the ultimate variant number asymmetry we produce in this way, assuming there's no washout, is that the variant density per unit entropy goes like is simply the asymmetry times our X yield from the non-thermal production. So in pictures, what's happening is that we have our X decay. The X decays a little bit more into three quarks versus anti-Y, anti-Phi. Our anti-X decays a little bit less into three anti-quarks, but a little bit more into Y5. So again, at this point, we still haven't violated this generalized variant number. But what we have done is sequester. We put a little bit more of the generalized variant number in the visible side into three quarks, and a little bit more on this side into Y5. Again, this is fairly analogous to direct leptogenesis. Okay, our third step is annihilation. In the same way that if you have a baryon number asymmetry, baryons and antibaryons essentially annihilate away completely until you're only left with the excess of baryons over antibaryons. So you get rid of all the antibaryons. What we have here is our Y and Phi can annihilate away through the Z prime. Completely analogously, this is in fact why we introduced the new gauge signature, to give it an efficient annihilation channel. Once you annihilate it this way, these states can decay into standard model light states. And this is very efficient provided that the Z prime mass is less than the Y and Phi mass. Okay, so the diagram of this is, remember, I have my asymmetries from the decay, and now I just annihilate everything away. The annihilation gets rid of the bulk piece, and what I'm left with at the end of the day is a little bit of an excess asymmetry in quarks and an equal and opposite anti-asymmetry in Wi-Fi. So now, if we can arrange for these states to be stable, and we want them to be stable because if they're not stable, they'll just decay into three quarks and wash out my asymmetry and kill off my baryon asymmetry, I can have Y and Phi set the dark matter density, and I need them to be stable, so in other words, it's not very natural for them to be the dark matter. Okay, so this production mechanism gives a number density of Y equal to the number density of Phi equal to the number density of baryons. And for stability, we need two conditions. We want the mass difference between Y and Phi to be less than essentially nucleon mass. And this prevents, let's say, the heavier of these two decaying into the lighter anti-state plus the baryon. And we also want to make sure that we don't have proton decay into Y and Phi, so that gives us a second condition. Now, to get the right dark matter density, given these number density relations, we want the sum of the masses to be roughly a baryon mass times the ratio of the dark matter density to the baryon density, and this is about 4.5 GeV. So taking this requirement plus this condition gives us a mass range for our Y and Phi states, that they have masses between about 1.7 and 2.9 GeV. Okay, so this is just a brief intermission with a non-physics cat picture. Okay, so... so this mechanism works. We can get a large enough asymmetry. We can explain the dark matter density, we can explain the baryon asymmetry, and we can relate them through this mass relation. And the question is, within this mechanism, how can you probe it? So again, recall that we have Y and Phi. These are both dark matter states. And they couple to this Z prime vector boson. They kinetically mix with the standard model. And there are various ways you can look for the theory. You can look for the Z prime directly, either in collider or precision experiments. You can look for elastic scattering of Y and Phi up nuclei through the Z prime. One of the more interesting things, and this is one thing we looked into fairly closely, is that because our dark matter now carries anti-baryon number, you can actually destroy nucleons through inelastic dark matter scattering. And finally, there are various monodense signals that were alluded to in one of the earlier talks. Okay, so I won't say much about the light Z prime signals. We've just heard a lot of this from Jim, but I just wanted to mention that Philip and Natalia have done a lot of work on this, and they're actually even doing an experiment to probe this massive. Okay, so because of our Z prime coupling, we have dark matter elastic scattering, and our dark matter is fairly light, and this means that our elastic scattering constraints are actually fairly mild. So recall that we want dark matter masses in the range of 2 to 3 GeV. So that means that on this plot, we're living way up here. So we can actually live with very large elastic cross-sections. And for example, parametrically, for spin-independent cross-section through our Z prime, taking the U1 prime coupling to be 0.05, with a pretty small gauge coupling, and a very light Z prime, we're very safe. And you can move this around, but the elastic scattering is, because we're so light, not terribly constrained. Something more interesting, more unusual, and more specific to the scenario is nucleon destruction. So our dark matter out carries a net anti-baryon number under this generalized baryon charge. And through the couplings that I wrote down earlier, the XUDD coupling can connect to the XYFI coupling. And what you can get is a dark matter state, either Y and Phi, coming in, exchanging an X with the constituents of a proton, turning the proton into a meson, and having an anti-dark matter state come out. So the upshot, the generic feature, is we have Y or Phi come in with the nucleon, and out comes anti-dark matter state plus a meson. So this process still conserves our generalized baryon number, but it just shovels it from the visible sector to the hidden sector.
Before you go, can I ask you? So if the cross-section of scattering on nucleon is very large, right, you could accumulate a lot of that in the center of the sun, and they can undergo this and generate...
Oh, I'll talk about that. It's not an issue, but I'll talk about that. OK, so we call this process induced nucleon decay, because it looks like nucleon decay. You don't see the decay products, you don't see the dark matter coming in, you don't see the dark decay products coming out. All you see is a nucleon turning into a meson with possibly fairly funny kinematics. So if I compare the rate for nucleon decay, which is just the decay rate of nucleon times the number of nuclei in my sample, compared to the rate for this process, which is a scattering cross section times the flux times the number of targets, I can find an effective lifetime through induced nucleon decay for earthbound detectors as this cross-section tends to look with our pattern flux. Okay, so one thing that I find kind of neat is that if I plug in the couplings, if I plug in the interactions and I compute this rate, what I find is an effective lifetime for IND of about 10 to 32 years if the mass parameters in my theory are near TV. So So if I have low-scale supersymmetry, this seems like a natural place to have these mass parameters. And this puts me right in the region that nuclear decay experiments such as super-K are sensitive to. And just in passing, let me mention that an effective lifetime of 10 to 32 years corresponds to an effective scattering cross-section of about 10 to the minus 39 centimeters cubed per second. So way, way less than what you'd have for, let's say, dark matter annihilation, which is on the order of 10 to the minus 26 centimeters cubed. Now, so induced nucleon decay could be picked up in these nucleon decay experiments, but the twist is that our kinematics are a bit different. So instead of just a nucleon at rest decaying into some mesons, we have dark matter coming in and scattering off the target. And the upshot of that is that the kinematics of the meson coming out can be quite different from standard nucleon decay. So, for example, if I look at, for example, nucleon going to a pion, a standard nucleon decay, kinematics just gives you a meson momentum of 460 MeV. On the other hand, for downscattering induced nucleon decay, we have considerably higher outgoing meson momentum. And the upshot of this is that standard nucleon decay searches that make use of momentum cuts based on standard nucleon decay kinematics may or may not be sensitive to this induced nucleon decay process. Okay, so for example, taking the UDS operator, this can induce apparent proton decay to a K plus. And this plot shows as a function of the fermion mass and the effective IND cross section, the relative rates for, I guess, two relevant operators. So if you focus on this one, this operator is a total rate for two processes. So there's an upscattering process and a downscattering process. The upscattering process cuts off as you increase the mass. The downscattering process picks up as you flip around the masses. And if you take the super K bounds for proton decay to K plus, their momentum windows are only sensitive to masses in this dark gray band or this dark gray band. So we have lots of regions here, here, and here for which the super K analyses are not sensitive at all. So one thing we've been pushing with various super K people is that they can take their existing data and do a reanalysis with slightly loosened cuts and pick up sensitivity to this induced nucleon decay process.
The original cuts, weren't they motivated by spurious backgrounds they have around there?
Yes, but they're also optimized given the fact that you have some momentum window for your for the meson coming out. So it's a combination of the two. I mean, of course you want to get rid of the backgrounds, but if you expect your meson to be in a certain window, you're going to cut on that simply to reduce the backgrounds. So yes, loosening these is going to pull in more background, but we're also fairly unconstrained in terms of the rate. So there is a lot of additional sensitivity or additional reach they could have by rejigging their by modifying their cuts.
So do you know what it is in terms of like 10 to the third units of 10 to the 32? Do you know how much would be the reach?
It's going to depend on the channel. I mean out here. So we didn't try running anything too careful, but we spoke to a lot of people, and it looks like you wouldn't reduce the sensitivity compared to your best fits by, let's say, more than order of magnitude, but still picking up sensitivity, order unity sensitivity to these signals. So the cut loosening we want to do, it's not opening a floodgate of background.
I think the current best fit is around 10 to 33, so you might lose it up to closer to 10 to 33.
Thank you.
I should also mention that the IMD3 nuclear decay search has some unexplained events. We didn't try to remove it. Okay, so Maxine, this actually touches on what you said. One of the things we worried about is this process, the IND process, could lead to are dark matter eating out stars. So the picture is we have our dark matter floating around in a halo. It collects on a star, it scatters, it's captured, it thermalizes, and it sinks down to a dark matter core.
That's actually an unlikely picture. It's much more likely for the scatter different sides than the solids.
It's a cartoon.
I know, but I mean it does hinges on the point that as you accumulate it in the core, you're then later on much more likely to scatter it in the dark matter itself in the core.
Oh, we don't reach. Well, sorry, but we don't reach large enough densities to do that. So what happens is we capture whatever. We form a dark matter core. Within this dark matter core, we reach a large enough density that we do start destroying baryons through ionic. So what happens here is we collect in the core. Our dark matter destroys a nucleon, forming anti-dark matter plus a meson. The anti-dark matter can either escape the star, if it's optically thin. If it's optically thick, it's likely to be captured. And this anti-dark matter, if it's captured, will annihilate another dark matter state there. Or just flies off, but not optically thin. The thing we worry about most were neutron stars and white dwarfs, simply because they're very, very dense. And what we find is that, at least for reasonable IND rates, the IND process matches the capture. So we reach a steady state where the rate at which dark matter is destroyed through IND matches the rate at which it's captured in the star. And this leads to a steady state that contributes to the heating of the star. We find that the stellar heating is not terribly it's not terribly measurable effect. It could be possibly important for globular clusters, but here there's arguments about how much dark matter you have in globular clusters. But the upshot is that after all this nuclear destruction and annihilation, blah blah blah, our process ends up looking basically the same as regular dark matter capture and self-annihilation. And the net effect is simply dumping energy into the star and heating the star.
Well, what about neutrinos from those zones?
I'll say about something in a second. So you're worried about the sun. Yeah, so just a second. I just wanted to mention that we worried a bit about eating up neutron stars. If you look at the number of baryons destroyed in a neutron star over the lifetime of the star, unless you have an enormous local dark matter density, it's not an issue. The number of baryons you destroy in the neutron star is a tiny, tiny fraction of the total. So the other thing we looked at is solar bounds. So you can capture it the same way on the sun. Here, it's because the sun is less dense, you may or may not reach a steady state. And you could potentially produce neutrons from the process. They're going to be very low energy. So for example, searches for upward muon fluxes at Amanda or Ice Cube, their energy thresholds are much larger than the neutrino energy we would have.
How about energetic five-star white bar? Because you can give them energies of a few tens of a unit, presumably, and they have huge cross-sections, so they can reach the neutrino detectors and cause some havoc, right? Because they have large cross-sections, but normal matter, much larger than neutrinos. Right? So it would scatter, produce 15 MeV line and the excitations of carbon, all these cross sections are very large.
Yeah, so we haven't looked into the ejection of the electrons. But actually, one thing I do want to mention though is that
it's probably you can do it right away, right? Estimate the flux of this 5-star and white bar from the sun.
Yeah, but actually, one thing I wanted to mention though is that the rate for this is actually not that large. Because our dark matter is so light that you actually have a fair bit of evaporation. So you don't actually capture that much. So you actually convolve the flux with the amount of
evaporation. So what's the punishment in the rate? You know, normally you get as many 5-stars as you get captured in the sun, but then you have
The sun is also typically optically thin. So the 5-stars escape. We don't capture the 5-stars.
Pardon?
You don't capture the 5-stars in the sun.
I think
that's right. So that's why you get it on Earth, right?
Uh-huh.
with some.
Yes, no, but I'm saying that the rate at which this occurs isn't that big because you actually saturate through evaporation,
okay.
Typically before you saturate through ion. But the
and how is it parametrically? Is it the small factor wash?
So this evaporation is very, very sensitive to dark matter mass. If evaporation turns on, it turns on exponentially. But it's very sensitive to the mass, so we're really on the edge of where evaporation is important. But typically we find that you saturate through a balance of capture and evaporation rather than through the IND in the sun. Okay, so one other signal of the setup is monojets. So we have monojets both from direct dark matter production, but also through our higher dimensional XQDD operator. So we looked into this. One issue, though, is that if a higher dimensional operator comes in around TUD, we have to worry that our momentum exchange in this process is on the same order as the higher dimensional operator scale that we're suppressing. So we didn't want to write down a full UV completion, but we stuck in a quick fix. And that quick fix was that depending on how we connect the Fermi operators, we replaced our high dimensional operator either by something that looked like an F-channel propagator with a width or a T-channel propagator. And this propagator width we put in here, it's unspecified without writing down UV completion, but it in a sense parameterizes our sensitivity to the details of it. So applying this to the Tevatron to the monojet search, we get bounds on our higher dimensional scale that depend fairly sensitively on our assumed width, but that vary on the order of a few hundred GeV for this higher dimensional mass scale. So this upper line corresponds to a narrow width, and the dashed green line is a broad width. We can do the same thing at the LHC. I haven't had a chance to update this with the new Atlas monojet searches, but at least taking an older study by Vakuman Hinchcliffe, assuming, a full LHC data set of 14 TeV, you have sensitivity up to about 7 femtobarn cross sections. So the 7 femtobarn cross section corresponds to this dashed line. And this would give a sensitivity to mass scales on the order of a few thousand GeV. Now, one thing that I find pretty neat is that the sensitivity of the LHC comes in at about the same level of sensitivity of nuclei decay searches to the IND process. So there's an interesting and slightly unusual correlation between these very, very different search methods. Okay, and then finally, there's also a gel-yan signal, but it's not an issue because our mediator is light. Okay, so let me just wrap up. Our heliogenesis mechanism realizes dark matter as hidden antibaryons. It gives a simultaneous explanation for dark matter, the baryon asymmetry. The factor of 5 between the dark matter and baryon densities translates into a mass ratio. And we have a very wacky new inelastic dark matter scattering signal that we call induced nucleon decay. It's fairly specific to this setup. And there are also related LHC monojet signals. And we're working on model building it into SUSE.
More questions? Okay. Is a SUSE building here just for model building, or are you getting more signatures out of this?
We're doing two things. Well, we're trying to model build a light scalar. So we're model building a light scalar using supersymmetry to stabilize it. And we're also UV completing the UDD operator. So you can do that with new triplets, running with flavor and LHCs.
Yeah, let's thank David again.